one, I guess, autobiographical sketch called Night by Elie Wiesel, and the other is an American novel by William Styron called Sophie's Choice. We'll look at those two tonight and try to address the question, when does silence support evil? And that's really the gist, I think, or one of the major themes in both of those books. And we'll consider that in lots of different ways. I thought maybe the way to begin would be to have you just think for a couple seconds of any time in your life when your action or your lack of action supported bad behavior. Sometime when you saw something wrong and you walked away, or just were silent, or just watched and didn't participate.
Bad joke.
You know, I'll write a couple of these down, in fact. Bad jokes meaning...
Racial,
yeah, good.
Degrading. Disallowed. And then worse than that. Go along with laughing.
Yeah, racially degrading, sexuality degrading, Norwegians... Tough one. You know, what is it that's different? How many Norwegians are in here? Would you all leave, please? I gotta raise my hand. What is it that's different about a Norwegian joke and an African American joke? Yeah?
Well, for one thing, you're sort of laughing at yourself. It's often told to Scandinavian people.
Yeah.
And also, Norwegians are not really oppressed.
Yeah. They should be, but they're not.
Yes.
Okay, that's an important distinction, right? That African Americans have a history of oppression in America, and Norwegians don't, except by the Swedes. And they just tried to and couldn't. Okay, anything else? Where you just turned your back, or were silent, or, yeah.
Yeah. I was walking down Woodlawn Avenue, about 100, one night, years ago, in Chicago, and I heard a scream, and there was one of those tunnels. In many apartment buildings, there's a kind of tunnel that goes under the building into the back, and there was a woman and a man, and I didn't go. Later, I found that she was
rich. Wow. Maybe not too many of us have heard screams. Or maybe some of us have heard screams but didn't hear screams. Not long ago, I was in the backyard of my home, and we have this narrow patch of woods. It's real thick, but it's about as wide as this room. And I was back there turning over a compost pile. And I saw my neighbor grab his little daughter by the throat and slap her across the face. And I just kind of watched, thinking, well, that's not the way to do it, but that's his business. And, he hit her twice. And I was silent. And I didn't expect myself to call the police or anything, perhaps. But in these kinds of, what could I have done?
I didn't know you were there.
Yeah, and I didn't. I just kind of stayed there, glad I was covered by the bushes. I stopped shoveling, and I watched with great interest, but I was silent. And I don't like myself about that, or I didn't like myself for that action. Anybody else?
Another time that silence supports evil is when I don't get around to writing that legislator, or I don't get around to making that lobbying phone call, and something that I really think is important, but I just don't take action.
Yeah, and I've just written it, not writing quotes around it, the powers. Okay, so some of us have some pretty dramatic things that we've heard or seen and just kept walking. We just tolerate the bad jokes. Go ahead a little further, yeah.
Yeah, not just jokes, but just statements that are derogatory of people. Comments about, the thing I'm particularly sensitive to, comments about gays and lesbians.
Yeah.
That someone to say something as a matter of fact in the course of a conversation and not challenging them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great example. Is there anybody else? Well, yeah.
Not preaching prophetically when the occasion or the situation or the circumstance demands.
And can you be
that situation
concrete?
Or whatever. Well, the situation, or perhaps, well, the situation of the gays and lesbians, you know, not telling the congregation flat out, everyone is welcome in this church, regardless of who they are, regardless of what the situation is.
Okay, good. Yeah, very good.
I think when you feel the inner pain, and you're afraid to make yourself vulnerable by expressing it, I think that silence needs to be expressed. In other words, expressing, I'm being introspective though much more than looking at something from the outside.
So now it's a different category, sort of, not when we were silent, but what causes us to be silent, perhaps, the inner pain, and coupled with your other word, vulnerability. Yeah, good.
Well, I got another couple of days ago, a Lutheran pastor was expressing his extreme concern about these two Lutheran churches that have ordained gay and lesbian men, which is in Southern California. And he'd go anywhere to speak against it. And he said, we are a biblical church. And I felt like saying, go sell all you have and give to the poor. I didn't say
it. Yeah, wow, it's another powerful story. We've got two examples here. In these situations, why don't we speak up? Why don't we say something?
A lot of times I think we're so shocked that we think of something 5 minutes later.
So it caught us off balance. And,
we want to avoid confrontation.
I've been afraid of personal injury and retaliation. If I stick up for somebody else, you get hit.
Okay. Our vulnerability, this is still not. We're shocked. We want to avoid confrontation. We want to avoid injury to ourselves.
We kind of want to be real positive that we're understanding the situation properly before we jump in and believe.
Yeah.
Nothing more embarrassing than giving somebody a tongue lashing and finding out you love them at all.
Well, I didn't think it was doing it good.
Save your energy.
You got to get involved in a long conversation.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
Here. Okay. Oh, you don't know your place. I just threw you a piece of chalk. It was on 4. I said that, and you didn't. What I did is just throw a short piece of chalk. I got a longer one. I know everybody wanted to know that story. Well, look at some of the words we've got up here. Vulnerability, our own. We're shocked. We want to avoid confrontation. We want to avoid injury. You can't read my writing, so I have to read it for you. Uncertain, or our own sense of confidence isn't there. Or we see the whole situation as kind of hopeless. Why bother? We used to have a neighbor, a real nice guy. He was about 83 and real active, and he used the word nigger all the time. And my professional life, not to speak of my professional life has really pretty much been devoted to my images, to see that everybody can sit in the bus where they want to. I never said anything to him. He was a good old guy, and I thought, why bother? The old tricks, you know, story. My wife didn't tolerate it, though. She spoke up very nicely. Just said, you know, we don't use that word around our house. And the guy said, oh. And that stopped it. It's crazy how easy it can be sometimes, isn't it? Well, okay. Anything else? Any other observations about this whole complex response or lack of response? Yeah.
We may find ourselves with something not quite as cut and dried and be very afraid that our conviction will be changed.
So I'm going to write the word down, ambivalence or ambiguity, or we're not so sure ourselves about that. And so just keep quiet. And part of that ambivalence probably is knowledge. No? And we don't know enough about it. I mean, somebody says, Well, the Bible says that gays and lesbians can't be part of any... Well, does it really say that? I don't know, so I'm not going to argue.
Then there's the case, I think, sometimes where we become lazy. We know the difference, but we choose to let somebody else do it. No. Complacent or lazy, I'm not quite sure. Maybe one and the same.
Looking for the easier way out.
Yeah. I don't want to bend down anymore. Easy way out.
Easy way out.
We can't have any more because I have to bend down. No, sorry. Well, now, we'll stop here because we want to get into this great literature. Are there any generalizations that you'd like to make about those generalizations? Do you see any pattern in our own human nature? That's what literature is. Literature is a look at an experience with human nature. It's not a philosophical treatise. It's not something about telling us about beauty or purpose in life. It clarifies the human experience. And literary criticism, what we'll be involved with together today, is just that. How do we clarify, give order and shape and meaning to those experiences of life? Only the experiences of life we're going to look at are beyond our experience, I suspect. Which is another reason for literature. It takes us beyond our own immediate experience into others. But anyway, the generalizations about those generalizations, do you see any pattern? Do you see anything that you'd like to say? I'm not fishing. I don't have an answer to that. I just wonder.
Just what I see is it's focus on self.
Yep.
Desire to protect ourselves and relate to your other soft pain on the branch of control.
Self is the thing that I've circled it twice. Self-focus, protect ourselves. And it surely is a sense of self over community. I would generalize, as a teacher and as a student of literature, that one of the great things literature does is give us the sense of connectedness to others. That's one of its major purposes. And there are all kinds of places we can find that in the Old and the New Testament. And then maybe some of the most famous line of all for lots of us is John Donne's, you know, in the 16th century or 17th century language, "No man is an island." And if you were writing today, he'd say, "Sorry, women, you don't get out of that one either." No women are, you know, we can't live as an island. Well, all literature, one way or another, I think, directs us toward that. Well, that's kind of an interesting generalization. Are there any others that you can think of? Or let's move on. Great, because now I'm getting pretty low and I have to bend over a lot now.
Flip the backboard over.
What?
Flip the backboard over.
And I have to flip my shoulder so hard. Actually, I don't. I'm just kidding. I don't need the blackboard anymore anyway. We're done with that. Well, that's the direction we're going to go as we look at these two pieces of literature now, is to see how these two pieces, Elie Wiesel's Night and William Styron's Sophie's Choice, become representative of all of these concepts, but most especially of this general theme that we talked about, that you talked about, and that you set us up for, the sense of looking at others beyond oneself, and the sense of experiencing the connectedness that we have to others. I'd like to start with Elie Wiesel's Night and set up the incredible story as he tells it. How many people have read this? Yeah, good. It's on sale in the bookstore. There's one copy of Night by itself, and there are several copies of his trilogy, Night, Dawn, and the Accident. And it's all there, and I believe also that it's in the bookstore, I mean in the library here too. But it's a cheap little book that's worth whatever you'd have to pay for, I guess. Elie Wiesel is 14, and his family is loaded up in the boxcars and carted off to Auschwitz. Auschwitz is, everybody knows, we'll clarify this,
death
a death camp, and a work camp is connected with it. Birkenau, in fact, is the death camp, and Auschwitz is the work camp, and they're side by side, and that's part of the incredible concentration camp system that the Nazis have set up. They're in the train. Auschwitz. No one had ever heard that name. We would be getting out here. There was a labor camp. Conditions were good. Families would not be split up. At 10 in the evening, everyone was looking for a convenient position in which to sleep for a while, and soon we were all asleep. What they've been experiencing on this trip is a woman that he's called Madame Schlachter. And Madame Schlachter has been having visions, and the visions have been of fire. And long before they get there, and long before anyone knows what goes on at these death camps. In fact, an interesting setup for this is that the beadle of their town, in which Wiesel and his family live, somehow, I mean, he gets arrested and taken off. Somehow, no one understands it, let alone Wiesel in the book, the guy gets off. They don't take him to a camp, and they send him back home. How that happens, no one knows. But he comes back and tells everybody in the village they're carting up the Jews, and they're putting them in boxcars, and they're taking them off to burn them and gas them. They told him the story. Don't give me that. We don't believe it. And it's so unthinkable, and it's clear in this book that it is so unthinkable to everybody in the community that they can't even, no, it can't be true. And as the, well, then we have this woman who has been seeing these visions, and now everybody's on the train, they're all asleep, suddenly, the fire, the furnace, look over there. Waking with a start, we rushed to the window. Yet again, we had believed her, even if only for a moment, but there was nothing outside save the darkness of night. As she continued to scream, they began to hit her again, and it was with the greatest difficulty that they silenced her. Toward 11 o'clock, the train began to move. We pressed against the windows. The convoy was moving slowly. A quarter of an hour later, it slowed down again. Through the windows, we could see barbed wire. We realized that this must be the camp. We had forgotten the existence of Madame Schachter. Suddenly, we heard terrible screams. Jews, look! Look through the window! Flames, look! And as the train stopped, we saw this time that flames were gushing out of a tall chimney into the black sky. We looked at the flames in the darkness. There was an abominable odor floating in the air. Suddenly, our doors opened. Some odd-looking characters dressed in striped shirts and black trousers leaped into the wagon. They held electric torches and truncheons. Everybody, get out! Everybody, out of the wagon, quickly! Men to the left, women to the right. 8 words spoken quietly, indifferently, without emotion. 8 short, simple words. Yet that was the moment when I parted from my mother. I had not had time to think, but already I felt the pressure of my father's hand. We were alone. For a part of a second, I glimpsed my mother and my sisters moving away to the right. Zipporah held mother's hand. I saw them disappear into the distance. My mother was stroking my sister's fair hair, as though to protect her, while I walked on with my father and the other men. And I did not know that in that place, at that moment, I was parting from my mother and Zipporah forever. I went on walking. My father held onto my hand. Form fives. Commotion. At all costs, we must keep together. Hey kid, how old are you? It was one of the prisoners who asked me this. I could not see his face, but his voice was tense and weary. I'm not quite 15 yet. No, 18. But I'm not, I said. 15. Fool, listen to what I say. Then he questioned my father, who replied, 50. The other grew more furious than ever. No, not 50, 40. Do you understand? 18 and 40. You get that? If you're too old, gas, you're too young. Okay. He disappeared into the night shadows. A second man came up spitting oaths at us. What have you come here for, you sons of bitches? What are you doing here, huh? Someone dared to answer him. What do you think? You suppose we've come here for our own pleasure? Do you think we asked to come? A little more and the man would have killed him. You shut your trap, you filthy swine, or I'll squash you right now. You'd have done better to have hanged yourselves where you were than to come here. Didn't you know what was in store for you at Auschwitz? Haven't you heard about it in 1944? No, we had not heard. No one had told us. He could not believe his ears. His tone of voice became increasingly brutal. Do you see that chimney over there? See it? Do you see those flames? Yes, we did see the flames. Over there. That's where you're going to be taken. That's your grave. Over there. Haven't you realized it yet? You dumb bastards, don't you understand anything? You're going to be burned, frizzled away, turned into ashes. We've got to do something. We can't let ourselves be killed. We can't go like beasts to the slaughter. We've got to revolt. One of the young men cried, let the world learn of the existence of Auschwitz. Let everyone hear about it while they can still escape. But the older ones begged their children not to do anything foolish. The wind of revolt died down. We continued our march toward the square. In the middle stood the notorious Dr. Mengele, a typical SS officer, a cruel face but not devoid of intelligence, and wearing a moniker. A conductor's baton in his hand, he was standing among the other officers, the baton moving unremittingly, sometimes to the right, sometimes to the left. I was already in front of him. "How old are you?" he asked in an attempt at a paternal tone of voice. 18. My voice was shaking. "Are you in good health?" "Yes." "What's your occupation?" Should I say that I was a student? "Farmer," I heard myself say. This conversation cannot have lasted more than a few seconds. It had seemed like an eternity to me. The baton moved to the left. I took half a step forward. I wanted to see first where they were sending my father. If he went to the right, I would go after him. The baton once again pointed to the left for him too. A weight was lifted from my heart. Not far from us, flames were leaping up from a ditch. Gigantic flames. They were burning something. A lorry drew up at the pit and delivered its load. Little children. Babies. Yes, I saw it. Saw it with my own eyes. Those children in the flames. Is it surprising that I could not sleep after that? Sleep had fled from my eyes. So this was where we were going. A little farther on was another and larger ditch for adults. That's a powerful section, isn't it, out of Night? And that's our introduction to Auschwitz, and our introduction of one man, one boy, with his father being taken there, knowing full well what's happening. Many years later, Wiesel won the Nobel Prize for Literature. I'd like to read part of his speech. "It is with a profound sense of humility that I accept the honor you have chosen to bestow upon me. I know your choice transcends me. This both frightens and pleases me. It frightens me because I wonder, do I have the right to represent the multitudes who have perished?" Now, this is a guy, just think of the silence problems we've encountered. And now he's got to say, can I represent other people at all? And Styron, we're going to see him ask the same kind of question, even with another kind of perspective. But just listen to the difficulty. "It frightens me because I wonder, do I have the right to represent the multitudes who have perished? Do I have the right to accept this great honor on their behalf? I do not. That would be presumptuous. No one may speak for the dead. No one may interpret their mutilated dreams and visions. It pleases me because I may say that this honor belongs to all the survivors and their children, and, through us, to the Jewish people with whose destiny I have always identified. I remember, it happened yesterday or eternities ago, a young Jewish boy discovered the kingdom of Night. I remember his bewilderment. I remember his anguish. It all happened so fast. The ghetto, the deportation, the sealed cattle car, the fiery altar upon which the history of our people and the future of mankind were meant to be sacrificed. I remember, he asked his father, can this be true? This is the 20th century, not the Middle Ages. Who would allow such crimes to be committed? How could the world remain silent? And now the boy is turning to me. Tell me, he asks, what have you done with my future? What have you done with your life? And I tell him that I have tried, that I have tried to keep memory alive, that I have tried to fight those who would forget, because if we forget, we are guilty, we are accomplices. And then I explained to him how naive we were, that the world did know and remained silent. And that is why I swore never to be silent whenever and wherever human beings endure suffering and humiliation. We must always take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented. Any comments so far on any of that? The Israelis have a word or a phrase they call the righteous Gentile. You heard that? It's an award.
Yes.
And it's an award they give to people who have risked their lives. And Irene Gut is one of those. I heard her speak just at our Quad City where I live, when I'm not living here, back in on the border of Illinois and Iowa. She came to speak at our Holocaust Remembrance, and she had quite a while ago, gotten this award, The Righteous Gentile. And her book called Into the Flames is the story of her account risking her life again and again and again and again to save 12 Jews. And she, at one point in her speech, she's about 75 years old now, she said she was living in a house with a German officer. She was his housekeeper, nothing else. She was his housekeeper. And he liked her a lot and really took good care of her. And unbeknownst to him, she was hiding 12 Jews in the house. And he would leave, and he just trusted her so explicitly and implicitly that he never even gave it a thought. It couldn't be possible. And when somebody said, you've got Jews in your house, he said, you come out and search right now. And he resented, and he was angry, and he had them search the whole house, and of course they didn't find him. But one day he came home early, and they were sitting up in the kitchen drinking coffee. And he just said he was destroyed by this woman that he liked very much and had befriended and had been so good to. He said, okay, I've loved you all this time. Now you will be mine. He meant sexually. Now you'll be mine, and I'll be quiet about this. Because he, on the other hand, he also knew that he'd probably be put to death too, because it'd be hard to explain how they could live there all that time without him knowing it. Without him knowing it. Anyway, I'll never forget her action in the front of the in the pulpit up there, giving the speech. She said, small price to pay. So I just slept with him for months. I mean, he was old, he was ugly, she didn't like him. He'd been good to her, but you know, it wasn't anything that she was attracted to in any sense of the imagination. My point in that whole story is, righteousness with that award is a completely different concept than most of us give that word. For us, probably, righteousness is refraining from evil. For the Jews in this award, righteousness is not just refraining from evil. Boy, I didn't put any Jews in the furnace. I didn't do anything. It's not a neutral stance. It's a positive, life-threatening, risk your life to get before one is called righteous. And that's an interesting counterpart, really, to the words and the focus that we had earlier, isn't it? When we all, and I'm among you, you know, when we all stand silent in certain, I wasn't very righteous as I stood silent. I don't beat my kids, so therefore I'm righteous, huh? Not in their category, because I watched while someone else did. Well, that whole concept takes us into, and we can debate this, please not here, outside, what I think is perhaps the greatest American novel ever written, Sophie's Choice. And we can debate that because lots of people don't agree with me on that. And I understand that, and that's really not my point. My point is, if after we discuss this, you're interested in reading that novel, I've brought along 4 pages of kind of study guides to help you. It's a difficult novel, but I've taught it now, without getting into how this all came about, because that's a story in itself. I've taught it now to college kids for 5 years, and I have my students evaluate the class and the text and so on after every term. And almost, it's a big class. I mean, we read good stuff. There's lots of students that like to take it. And 50, 60 students in the class every year, almost all of them say, not that Sophie's Choice was the best book in the course, but that Sophie's Choice is the best book they've ever read in their life. Almost all of them say that. Now, I've recommended this to several people, and they say, oh, I read the first 50 pages and put it away. I mean, that's stupid. Well, you know, I would say if you're interested in this after we get through it today, hang in there and keep going. But my goal isn't even to get you to read it. It's to get you to understand what literature can do and how, in particular, the focus on this book exemplifies the best in what literature can do. And that is, I think, one of the major things literature does and poets and writers do is to differentiate for us what is evil and what is good and they enable us how to tell the difference. And often the whole idea of the righteous Gentile, that concept, suggests a different way to recognize evil and good. I'm back there just chopping, turn over my compost pile, am I evil? Well, in Sophie's Choice, it might be argued that I am, because I was silent. And on it goes, and we'll see that. Okay, and we'll go right to this novel. This wonderful novel that I would put ahead of Moby Dick, I would put it ahead of Huckleberry Finn, I would put it ahead of My Field and My Dissertation, Richard Wright's Native Son. There are great books out there. This has a complexity to it that maybe makes it better. Again, I have lots of colleagues who say, Olson, you're crazy, there's no way you can come up to Moby Dick or Native Son, and I say, okay, that's not my point anyway. It's a story about a guy named Stingle. And he narrates this whole thing. And his vehicle for telling the story is about two people, primarily Sophie, and Sophie's lover in this book is Nathan. And Stingle and Sophie and Nathan come together early in the book in the same apartment house, and that's how they get acquainted and come together and become very, very good friends. But the story, I would say, is really about Stingle. And therefore, the story is really about us. We are as unacquainted, as Stingle says, with death in all but a stranger to love, as Stingle is, as he says about himself at the beginning of the book. He doesn't really know what, and it's a matter of knowledge, not just sensitivity. He doesn't really know what evil is, and this book is about his journey into evil through Sophie's stories that she unfolds for him throughout the long novel. And she tells her stories of, and she is a survivor of Auschwitz. She's a Gentile survivor of Auschwitz, suggesting to us, and I like this whole mechanism and this whole setup that Styron gives to the book, is that he has selected to be his fictitious protagonist, heroine, hero, a Gentile who survived Auschwitz, to suggest it wasn't just the Jews. How many people were killed in World War II in the concentration camps? What's the number that comes to mind for everybody? 6 million. How many people were really killed? Burned by the Nazis or gassed?
13.
Yeah. 11 or 12 or 13 million. And we have that much variation now, because now that we're getting in behind the Iron Curtain, we're finding records we didn't know that they were there and how many more people really did get killed. But we don't hear about that. And somehow, and those of you who have been in the classes where we've dealt with African American literature and dealt with the issue of racism, somehow, you know, if it's just the blacks who are suffering, somehow we want to stop it, but it's okay. I mean, we're able to turn our back on that. In the same way, the 6 million Jews, it wasn't that awful. You know, those of us who care about that was awful. But somehow, we see that the parameters of evil are somehow confining. But suddenly we move from 6 million to 12 million, and we see a protagonist that is not Jewish go through the hell of Auschwitz. And the parameters of evil are not so defined and so deliberate and so limited as we thought. Well, we have Stingo's story, and I'd like to take you through on that, and then we'll have lots of time, I think, to talk about that. This story opens with a lot of crazy stuff, and Styron is pretty good for humor, and he's got his character Stingle, the narrator, who has a job working as an editor for McGraw-Hill. That's a job that William Styron himself had at one time. And so in that sense, it's a little autobiographical, but it's so fictionalized that doesn't really matter. And this kid, 22-year-old young writer, and that's what he wants to do. I want to write a great book. I mean, the narrator of this story does, Stingle does. But I just can't write. The reason he can't write is, guess why someone couldn't write. Yeah, right. He has no experiences, he has no complexity, he has no depth. And here's why. And so he gets this job as an editor, and he gets to write the jacket covers for novels or different textbooks or whatever. And here's one of them that he writes. This was a history of Kleenex. And this is his jacket blurb, a little part of it. It is estimated that during one winter month alone, if all the snot blown into Kleenex tissues in the United States and Canada were spread over the playing surface of the Yale Bowl, it would reach a depth of 1.5 feet. My point in that is, of course, it's ridiculous and it's blech, but it's that's where Stingle is. And I would suggest to you that that's where we don't probably care about how much snot we fill up the bowl. But that's where he is. And he can't possibly write when he's concerned with such trivia. And still later, he comes home and he's concerned about, he's only got $50 left to last him and his job doesn't pay him much and he wants to take time off so he can just write. And he comes home and there's a whole page of him, just it's spelled out. He just lists all the things that are in his medicine cabinet. And for a paragraph, and a reader goes nuts. And we just said, who cares? And we thought, Barbasol, Schick. I mean, you just list these things for a page. You know, just go on, and you just kind of want to skip over it. What I'm suggesting to you is we become caught up and bored with the same things that he is caught up and bored with, and we couldn't write either. We don't have the knowledge. Well, then he meets a character in his at McGraw-Hill, his boss, who says this to him. I noticed that you don't wear a hat, the weasel said. A hat, I replied. Well, why no? I had always been lukewarm about headgear, feeling only that hats had their place, certainly since leaving the Marine Corps 2 years before. I had never thought of hat wearing as a compulsory matter. It was my democratic right to choose, and I had given the idea no further thought until this moment. Everyone at McGraw-Hill wears a hat, the weasel said. Everyone? I replied. Everyone, he said flatly. There's a couple paragraphs that go on, and Stengel says to him, may I ask in what other way I haven't fitted the profile? I cannot dictate your newspaper reading habits, nor do I want to, but it is not wise for a McGraw-Hill employee to be seen with a copy of the New York Post. This is simply advice for your own good. Needless to say, you can read anything you care to on your own time and in privacy. It just does not look seemly for McGraw-Hill editors to be reading radical publications at the office. Even I knew that the Post was hardly radical, and I was on the verge of saying so, but I held my tongue. Poor weasel. Cold a fish that he as he was, I suddenly felt a little sorry for him, realizing as I did that the snaffle he was trying to curb me with was not of his making. For something in his manner, could it have been the faintest note of apology, one Southerner reaching out to another in faltering, belated sympathy? Something in his manner told me that he had no real stomach for these foolish and sordid restrictions. Got a point so far? Early in the book. Weasels, Mr. Common Man. You know, you really need to wear a hat. And you know, you really shouldn't be reading the Post. And Weasel is like we are. A common, everyday, go to work, come home and love your kids, and listen to the radio in those days, kind of guy. What's happening already to us? Is there a Nazi mentality going on so early and such small, unimportant levels that it doesn't matter? And Stengel just brushes all this off. We're early in the novel. Okay. Well, Stengel finally gets fired because one day he brings to work one of those. Remember when you were kids, some of you do, I do, you'd blow that plastic stuff up like a balloon and it wouldn't be rubber, it was just like plastic. It would dry kind of hard and it would float off. He lets a whole bunch of these out the window and the secretaries all go out and look and they disturbs the whole place and the guy, Weasel, comes to him and said, you're out of here. So he leaves. In leaving, his co-worker, who was considerably older, tells him of his own son that was killed on Okinawa. Stengel's friend or co-worker is named Farrell. And Stengel says this about Farrell's story. Farrell's story had struck so deeply at my heart that for the first time in my life I was aware of the large hollowness I carried within me. It was true that I had traveled great distances for one so young. Listen to this phrase and look at it. This is us, readers. It was true that I had traveled great distances for one so young. But my spirit had remained landlocked. Unacquainted with love, and all but a stranger to death. And I could not realize then how soon I would encounter both of these things, love and death, embodied in the human passion and human flesh from which I had absented myself in my smug and airless self-deprivation. Nor did I then realize that my voyage of discovery would also be a journey to a place as strange as Brooklyn. And we have this phrase, early, that we all go on, a voyage of discovery. And as readers, we go with Stengel. And we go into this voyage of discovery all about Sophie, whom he meets now. And we'll just see how this gradually unfolds. And you can interrupt me anytime you want to if I haven't made the context of something clear, because I am going to now cover 629 pages in 10 minutes. Okay? So interrupt me. Anybody know the beginning line of Moby Dick?
Call me Ishmael.
Call me
Yeah, it's real famous lines in literature. Call me Ishmael. Well, this, the beginning of the second paragraph here starts out, call me Stingo. And I, as a literary person, that just somehow strikes me as it. He's setting up a parallel that Ishmael's journey into good and evil is going to be similar to Stingo's, call me Stingo, on this voyage of discovery with my landlocked soul into where I become acquainted with death and I won't be a stranger to love anymore. Well, he meets, well, first of all, he learns about a friend of his that committed suicide. And this just sets up some other ideas, and we'll see what happens. He gets a letter from his father of this woman named Mariah Hunt, who's a young girl, 22 his age, was dead. She killed herself by leaping from the window of a building, and I found to my astonishment that this had occurred only a few weeks before in Manhattan. I later learned that she had lived around the corner from me on 6th Avenue. This is a girl he dated way back in high school in the South in the Tidewaters of Virginia, and now they're both in New York, but he didn't know it. It was a sign of the city's inhuman vastness that we had both dwelt for months in an area as compact as Greenwich Village without ever having encountered each other. With a wrench of pain so intense that it was almost like remorse, I pondered whether I might not have been able to save her, to prevent her from taking such a terrible course, had I only known of her existence in the city and her whereabouts. Point? It's obvious. No, he wonders, if I'd have known, could I have saved her? And the incredible thing that we're going to learn as we go through the story is that everybody knew about what was going on behind the walls of the concentration camps. And they didn't save her. Could I have saved her? And that's sort of early in this book on page 51, a real kind of naive question about human nature and about the things that we just all listed, that we back away from. Could I have saved her? Well, maybe he could have, but this part of his voyage of discovery. Still later, he inherits, his father sends him a $500 check. Whoo, it's a lot of money in 1945. And the check comes from, they found buried in the backyard of their great-grandfather this jar full of gold coins, and they checked it in, and all the grandkids shared in this inheritance. But the inheritance came from the selling of a slave back in the slave days, of course. And Artiste is the character we meet then. I mean, that's the slave. And Stingo is real upset about living with and living off slave money, and it's not part of his own morality. But I don't have any money, and I can sure use it, and now I can write, and I just got fired from my job. I'll take this. So at the same time he gets that letter, he learns about a guy named Bobby Weed, who is fictional in here, but takes off really on the historical character of Emmett Till, who's a 15-year-old kid. This is true now. Emmett Till is a 15-year-old kid from Chicago who goes to the South to visit his aunt and uncle, whistles up, or he doesn't whistle, he talks kind of normal to a white woman, and, like, well, I'll see you later, honey, something like that. And that night, three white guys come to his uncle's house and say, is your nephew here? Yeah, what do you want? They take him out and kill him because he talked smart to a white woman. That's historical. I think the date of that is 1956. Bobby Weed is based somewhat on that. And let me read a sense of what goes on with that whole scene. To get Stingo's acquaintance with evil. Nathan, whom also is Sophie's lover, and he's met him in their apartment house, tells him that, I'll tell you something about Bobby Weed, Stingo, my friend, and that is this. You southern white people have a lot to answer for when it comes to such bestiality. You deny that? Then listen, I say this as one whose people, Nathan is Jewish, whose people have suffered the death camps. I say this as a man who is deeply in love, that's Sophie, with one who has survived them. I say that the fate of Bobby Weed at the hands of white Southern Americans is as bottomlessly barbaric as any act performed by the Nazis during the rule of Adolf Hitler. Do you disagree with me? God damn it, I'm not going to swallow that line, says Stingo. I'm Southern, and I'm proud of it, and I'm not one of those pigs, those troglodytes, that's just a cave dweller, you know, somebody on civil rights. Those troglodytes who did what they did to Bobby Weed. I was born in Tidewater, Virginia, and if you'll pardon the expression, I regard myself as a gentleman. Also, if you'll pardon me, this simplistic nonsense of yours, this ignorance coming from somebody who is so obviously intelligent as yourself, it truly nauseates me. What gives you the right to pass judgment? I find that offensive. Nathan, as a Jew, I regard myself as an authority on anguish and suffering. As for this New York liberal evasion, this hypocritical horseshit, I consider that a laughably feeble, insubstantial comeback to an honest accusation. Aren't you able to perceive the simple truth? Aren't you able to discern the truth in its awful outlines? And that is that your refusal to admit responsibility in the death of Bobby Weed is the same as that of those Germans who disavowed the Nazi Party, even as they watched blandly and unprotestingly as the thugs vandalized the synagogues and perpetrated the Kristallnacht. Stingle, pages later. I did feel, at my heart's core, a truly burdensome shame over the kinship I was forced to acknowledge with those solidly Anglo-Saxon subhumans who were the torturers of Bobby Weed, these Georgia backwoodsmen, denizens, as it so happened, of that same piney coast near Brunswick, where my own old slave, his grandfather's he means, had toiled and suffered. The sense now to get you into this book passed, I once had a colleague, he was kidding, I later learned, I didn't think so at first. He said, you're gonna teach Sophie's Choice? It's all about drugs and sex. There are some explicit sex scenes in this book, and they're there clearly to show you how unfulfilling those sex scenes can be in the life of a woman who's trying to do anything to get back her grip on life because she's lost her faith. I mention that only because after Stingo considers Bobby Weed's death, this is his response. I went to see a movie, and he thought about Bobby Weed. While he was still alive, Bobby Weed's cock and balls had been hacked off and thrust into his mouth. This feature had not been displayed in the papers. And when near death, though reportedly aware of all, he had been by a flaming blowtorch received the brand on his chest of a serpentine L, representing what? Lynch? Lula? Law and Order? Love? Even as Nathan raved at me, I recalled having semi-staggered out of the train and up into the bright summer light of 86th Street. I kept murmuring, endlessly it seemed, lines from Revelation I had memorized as a boy. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain. Stingle puts, from the beginning, every single action of evil he encounters in a theological or biblical context. And he wonders about Revelation, and he wonders about God. And then we'll skip all the way up to meeting Sophie and listen to Sophie tell him. Well, time's going fast. I'm going to skip a lot. How many people saw the movie, Sophie's Choice? Okay. The movie is about the psychological scars created by Sophie's survival of Auschwitz. The book is about theological/spiritual scars. Apostasy. Her faith has left her. I'm going to skip some of this too. I just looked at the time. She's describing her time in a Swedish restoration camp, a relocation camp after getting out of Auschwitz. And she'd been talking to a Swedish woman who was very religious. And I told her, I once believed in Christ and his Holy Mother too. But now after these years, I was like those Jews who think God was gone forever. I said that I knew that Christ had turned his face away from me, and I could no longer pray to him as I did once in Krakow. I couldn't any longer pray to him, or could I any more cry. And when she asked me how I know that Christ had turned his face away from me, I said I just knew. I just knew that only a God, only a Jesus who had no pity, and who no longer could care for me, could permit the people I loved to be killed and let me live with such guilt. It was a terrible enough they died like they done, those were our loved ones, but this guilt was more than I could bear. And guilt is a part that goes through this book, and Sophie's guilty because she doesn't participate in some of the resistance movements that she's asked to participate in. Can you steal the radio for us? And we can, you know, and she doesn't do it. And you know, Stingo, there is one piece of music that I cannot listen to. It makes me cry so much my nose stops up. I cannot breathe. My eyes run like streams. It is in these Handel records I got for Christmas. I know that my Redeemer liveth, that make me cry because of all my guilt, and also because I know that my Redeemer don't live, and my body will be destroyed by worms, and my eyes will never, never again see God. And that's the play of the words in that song. And though my body is destroyed by worms, I yet in my flesh shall see God. She says the aria in the, well, she knows she won't. I want to skip all the way up to Sophie's choice. It's a greater choice than this, but it's the most powerful scene, I think, in the book until the very ending. And this won't destroy anything for you to know this part of the plot, because the book itself is such a powerful experience. It only matters if I can find the page, that's all. Sophie is arrested. We learn this much, much later. And she's on the ramp. And we don't know this till late in the book either. She has two children, two little kids. Early in the book, we don't know about any. And then she slowly unfolds, because all of this is so repressed, and she doesn't want to confront it. She has no pictures, no memories, nothing in her American apartment to remind her of home, except she tells Stingo's stories. At first, they're lies. And she slowly uncovers the truth. And first, we learn of one child, and then we learn of two. And here's where we learn of two children. She's out of the railroad car, on the ramp at Auschwitz. And she comes face to face with Hauptfuhrer Fritz Jaemund von Niemann, doctor of medicine. The first words he said to her, for example, "Ich möchte mit dir schlafen," which means as bluntly and as unseductively as possible, "I'd like to get you into bed with me." Indisputably drunk, which might help explain his coarseness, he went on. But Sophie couldn't play dumb. Why hadn't she played dumb? Just nicht sprech Deutsch. It could have saved the moment. There was such a press of people. Had she not answered in German, he might have let the three of them pass through. But there was the cold fact of her terror, and the terror caused her to behave unwisely. "Ich bin Polnisch in Krakow geboren," she blurted out helplessly. "I'm not Jewish, or my children. They're not Jewish either. They are racially pure. They speak German. I am a Christian. I am a devout Catholic." I'm skipping a lot of the narration. "So you're not a communist. You're a believer." "Ja, mein Hauptmann, I believe in Christ." "So you believe in Christ the Redeemer. Did he not say, 'Suffer the little children to come unto me'?" He turned back to her, moving with the twitchy methodicalness of a drunk. Sophie, with an inanity poised on her tongue and choked with fear, was about to attempt a reply when the doctor said, "You may keep one of your children." "Bitte?" "You may keep one of your children. The other one will have to go. Which one will you keep?" "You mean I have to choose? You're a Polak, not a Yid. That gives you a privilege, a choice." "I can't choose. I can't choose. Ich cannot wird wollen." "Hurry now and choose. Choose, goddammit, or I'll send them both over there. Quick! Don't make me choose. I can't choose. Send them both over there, then. Knock, links. Mama!" She heard Eva's thin but soaring cry at the instant that she thrust the child away from her and rose from the concrete with a clumsy, stumbling motion. "Take the baby. Take my little girl." That's her choice. Take the little girl to Birkenau, the death camp. And the boy gets to go with her. Sophie's choice. Unthinkable, isn't it? And that evil is so carefully developed throughout the novel that it finally comes to this. And the last thing I'd like to show, the ending is a little more optimistic than this, and it's a book about faith and this journey and the struggle through and to faith. But I think one of the things that Wiesel said, that Styron also addresses, is important for us to consider. He meets a character, Stingo does, who has learned something about Sophie, and Sophie's told him just a little bit. And the guy says to Stingo, "Hey, Stingo, what's Auschwitz?" And it's spelled O-W. I mean, like, the guy doesn't know anything. And Stingo decides, what's Auschwitz? That's the problem. And this journey into, and this guy doesn't know anything. And Stingo has an observation for all of us about that. Sophie has told him her story, that "I was in the camp for 20 months in one day, for 20 months, and if it had been 20 months in one day, I know I would not have lived." Styron has Stingo recall a book, and this is our last statement about this. Rudolf Hess is the commandant of Auschwitz, and after he is arrested, he writes his autobiography, which is which is in a book called K.L. Auschwitz, is seen by the SS. It's a book I've read, and it just explains. At one point, Hess says this: "You people have asked me since my arrest why we didn't assassinate Hitler, why we didn't disobey Himmler, and all I can tell you is this. Of the thousands and thousands of SS officers that I know, not a one, he says it twice, can I imagine where it even crossed their mind." Remember Weasel? You can't read the post. And you must wear a hat. It never crossed their mind to disobey. So real evil, and here we have this last statement by Styron about the K.L. Auschwitz, and you'll get it all. In the K.L. Auschwitz, is this anatomy of Hess's, that's the commandant of Auschwitz, psych, is available for examination by all those who might thirst for knowledge about the true nature of evil. Certainly it should be read throughout the world by professors of philosophy, ministers of the gospel, rabbis, shamans, all historians, writers, politicians, diplomats, liberationists of whatever sex and persuasion, lawyers, judges, penologists, stand-up comedians, film directors, journalists, in short, anyone concerned remotely with affecting the consciousness of his fellow man. Within these confessions, it will be discovered that we really have no acquaintance with true evil. The evil portrayed, think about this, in most novels and plays and movies is mediocre, if not spurious, a shoddy concoction generally made up of violence, fantasy, neurotic terror, and melodrama. It was Hess, having observed the effectiveness of a crystallized hydrocyanic compound called Zyklon B when used as a vapor on the rats and other verminous creatures that infested Auschwitz, suggested this means of liquidation to Eichmann, who, according to Hess, jumped at the idea. The image we have there is we've got men sitting around a table and they decide, how do we kill them the fastest? And the carbon monoxide going into a truck didn't work. Too slow. So Hess comes up with Zyklon B. We can do it much faster. That's right. Instead of taking an hour and a half, it takes 10 minutes. I guess we have to stop there. What Sophie's Choice does in a phrase, then, is take us into this journey. And we are Stingo, and we go to this journey. I want to read to you, it's very, very short, this orange here, a poem written by a student. The way I introduced to my students back at Augustana this novel is to show them actual footage of the liberating of the Nazi concentration camps. I mean, it's the footage that the Russians and the British came in. You've all seen it, probably. You know, the bulldozers and the bodies, and it's awful stuff. And you almost have to debrief, my wife's word as a chaplain, from coming down from that. And the way we debrief is to let kids write poetry about that. Here's one that's not particularly good, but it speaks to all of us, I think. We've seen the movie, and we just, okay, guys, gals, just write whatever you want. It hurts to think about this. I just want to sit in silence. This is a 19-year-old college student. I can't think of words to describe what I just saw. Powerful enough words do not exist. I feel like I'm in a daze. It'd be nice to escape back to everyday life and my sense of reality. But that's the problem. What I saw was reality. And the student becomes on this, or goes on the same journey that Stingo does. From a student who's landlocked and unacquainted with death and all but a stranger to love, on this voyage of discovery into the complexity of evil, so we begin to recognize what real evil is. And after reading that novel, the first time I can remember saying to my then 10-year-old son, you know, I think maybe the thing most worthy of study in a college environment is the nature of evil. And I don't know if that's true, but as we begin to understand the true nature of evil, as this book does, we get a little more clarity, I think, on our connectedness and our role to that connectedness, in that connectedness, I mean, to all people, as we spelled it out in this first comment. Anybody have anything? We got about 5 minutes. Sorry, that's so long. I don't know how else to do it. If you're interested in Sophie's Choice, I have some works, some things that I give to my students. And for instance, it's an introduction to the book, and then there's 4 pages of quotations that in a long book, if you, I tell my students, go